Thanks for downloading this podcast from RNIB Connect Radio. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Hey, you're listening to the Happy Hour podcast, a trimmed down version of our hour-long show. If you're enjoying all the songs, along with the interviews, tips and chat, just catch the full show on RNIB Connect Radio. We're on every Monday at 1 p.m. with a repeat Thursday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m. But for now, enjoy the Happy Hour podcast. Hold On, I'm Coming by Sam and Dave on RNIB Connect Radio. Welcome to your latest episode of the Happy Hour, the show about all things happiness and well-being with your hosts Holly and Paulina. And it's a fun one this week as we bring you another book special.
Yes, it's our book special part two. And over the next hour, we'll hear some amazing interviews from fabulous authors like blind activist and motivational speaker Dr. Amit Patel, as well as the founder of the Secret Society of Happy People, Pamela Gale Johnson.
We'll also have a couple recommendation of books to read for comfort, our music therapy moment, and some happy random facts.
So all of that plus some great music here for the next hour, just like this Adele track, it's Oh My God.
I ain't got too much time to spare. To show how much I care, wish that I would let you break my walls, but I'm still spinning out of
control. How do we find happiness? It's a question that many of us struggle with on a day-to-day basis, but what if I told you there is a practical guide that could help? Practical Happiness is a new audiobook that's just been released by author and founder of the Society of Happy People, Pamela Gale Johnson. And Pamela is actually here with me to share some of that knowledge when it comes to chasing this elusive happiness. Pamela, it is so nice to have you here with us.
Thank you guys so much for having me on.
Before we chat about your book, tell us a little bit more about the Society of Happy People.
Well, we started over 20 years ago, so about 23, 24 years ago. We started kind of at what I would call the height of the self-help movement. We didn't have podcasts at that point, but we had talk radio, we had talk TV, books, workshops, seminars, everything really sort of centered around kind of our emotional wounds that we had received up to that point from childhood, on. And I just sort of started asking myself, well, where are all the happy people? That's not to say these wounds weren't real, but it was also like, you know, there's a lot of happiness that still takes place in life. So where are all the happy people? And I originally thought it would just be a funny humor essay about a club called, and at the time we were called Secret Society of Happy People. So about a club called the Secret Society of Happy People. And people, when I tell them about my idea for the essay, people would say, oh, let me know when you start it. I want to join. And so about a year later, I went ahead and kind of started it. So creating just a tribe for people who wanted to celebrate happiness.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. And you're based in America, am I right?
Well, we are based in America. We are global. We have members from just all over the world. I'd have to actually go look at the country counts. So we have members from most countries. If you have internet, you can access us. And we also started the first three happiness holidays that I'm aware of. So we've been celebrating them now all for over 20 years. I'm often told by social media posts that our Happiness Happens Day, which is in August, it's August 8th, and Happiness Happens Month, which is in August. The UK probably celebrates it as much as America or anywhere else in the world. Lots of organizations participate in that.
Wow. So you're obviously quite busy with the society, but you do have the book. Now, the full title is Practical Happiness, Four Principles to Improve Your Life. So what inspired you to pick up the pen and write.
Actually, at our 20-year anniversary, a reporter asked me, he said, what have you learned about happiness over the past 20 years? So it kind of just got me thinking. I'm like, well, what have I really learned? And ironically, I wouldn't say I had learned that much, but I did go put the foundation in place of sort of what the society had always stood for. We never told people that unhappiness didn't happen. We've always thought happiness was personal, and you know, happiness changes and happiness is bigger than you think. So those sort of, those became the four principles of the book.
Now, you kind of touched upon this a little bit. You said one of the principles was not really having to be happy 100% of the time, because I feel like sometimes we have this weird misconception that we should be happy 100% of the time. And if we're not, something's wrong with us.
Well, that's our second principle, which is we call them happiness zappers. And we say happiness zappers are manageable. And I think every single day we're going to wake up and there's going to be something that's trying to zap at our happiness. Now, it ranges in degrees. And we actually, like I said, have five types of happiness zappers. So again, how we manage those is what really does determine a lot of our happiness. Let's use this for an example. I think we would all agree that if you're at a wedding, that would just be, we would call that a happy moment. We would call that a happy event, and there's a lot of happiness. Having said that, if you're part of the bridal party or you're super close to the family or whatever, you're probably going to be aware, like I have never attended one, that there's not a little bit of chaos going on somewhere, whether it's a family situation, you've got, you know, aunt, somebody dancing on a table, or if it's something going on with the actual logistics of the wedding itself. You have some chaos that's taking place even in the midst of this super happy event. Conversely, if you're at a funeral, we would all agree that's a happiness zapping event. That's a sadness. People are grieving. But there's also people standing around celebrating that person's life, and they're having nostalgic memories. And nostalgia is a type of happiness. So happiness and unhappiness can be somewhat intertwined. So they're not totally exclusive of each other.
Now, you've explained it so well, but I do have to say, when I read your book, the thing that I guess I didn't expect to find there was homework.
Well, I wanted people to personalize these principles. And so the homework, as you call it, the homework helps you do that so that you can actually create your own, you know, zapper management action plan for a particular situation in your life. And again, it may change. So you may start, let's say you're having a zapper moment with a boss at work. And as that situation changes, your plan to manage it may change. Or sometimes we just don't sit down and think about happiness other than we just think we should feel happy. And I think happiness, which gets to the fourth principle, is bigger than you think. But it's not only bigger than you think, it's also, there's sort of degrees of happiness. So let's say you just went through a chaotic happiness zapping moment and your energy is just low and you're not feeling the funny happy or you're not feeling excited. You might just be relieved the chaotic moment is over. And because you feel better than you felt the moment before, you feel good. That's happiness. Happiness is when we naturally feel good. And that's a big part of redefining happiness so we experience more of it.
I feel like you're giving us so much advice there, and there's still more in your book. And one of the things that's really nice in the book is as well is all those personal stories you pulled from real life. What made you decide to include them in the book?
Well, I want people to relate to the principles in a practical way. And I think the only way you can really do that is when you see people put them in action. And I think, well, I can tell you the principles and your mind can go, oh, yeah, I get that. I think there's a big difference in knowing that in your head and seeing how somebody actually applied it to their life. I interviewed 60 people, and I think every one of them has some story or tidbit in the book. And I think that's what really makes it relatable.
Well, it's been amazing hearing about your book, and I do have one final question for you. What would be your top tip for happiness?
If I had to tell people one thing, you don't have to necessarily have a ton of relationships, but those significant relationships are probably the one thing that defines long-term happiness for people. So we all need people in our lives that we really do have a close kindred connection with. And I've met so many people on social media, and some of them I've met in person, and I have created some good relationships with them. But I think sometimes with social media, we've moved to this place that we sometimes think we have significant relationships with everybody when we actually have maybe a lot of acquaintances. If you were arrested and you needed bail money, who would you call? We need those relationships that if you're super sick and you need somebody to bring you chicken soup, who would you call? So if you don't really have one of those or a couple of those in your life, I would say try to start building those relationships.
No, that's amazing advice there. There's been so much information given here. Is there anywhere else we can go for more or to kind of expand our knowledge?
You can always visit the Society's website at sohp.com. And for your audience, if they would like to get our happiness counter, which identifies the 31 types of happiness to help them expand their idea of how big happiness is, if they go to sohp.com/gift, they can download the 31 types of happiness counter.
Practical Happiness, 4 Principles to Improve Your Life by Pamela Gale Johnson is now available as an audiobook through Audible and also on Kindle and paperback. So definitely worth checking it out. But for now, it's been so nice chatting with you, Pamela, and so nice having you on the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, all the parties on the streets are talking, storefront mannequins sleeping in lights. We used to smoke while we were jailed.
Lady Antebellum on the Happy Hour. We're chatting all things books and happiness on the show today, and I have a random fact for you.
I love random facts, hit me.
Did you know there's a word for loving the smell of old books?
Oh, really?
Now, everyone loves the smell of old books, right? Mm. They have the aroma of dust and a whole lot of history. Well, now you can call it something. Bibliosmia is the word you've probably been searching for your whole life.
Oh, gosh. You know what? That explains so much, because I feel like whenever you go to a library, one of the first things I used to always do is just pick up and smell the book.
Me too. And when you walk in, I feel like the smell just hits you. So when you walk into, say, a cafe or a restaurant, I feel like a library's the same, if you know what I mean.
How do you find that, like, if you're reading, because obviously you listen to a lot of audiobooks, do you miss smelling the book?
For anyone that's just tuned in, that'll sound really weird, but yeah, completely. I think there's just something really relaxing, quite therapeutic about smelling old books, and I do think that's one of the things you miss when listening to audiobooks. And in a way, I've never really thought about it until we're actually talking about it now. But yeah, I do actually miss that.
You know what? I bet you that there's a candle somewhere out there with the smell of old books. So we'll have a look. And if we ever find it, we'll pop it. We'll mention it in the next happy hour.
Yeah, we'll do a review. So whilst we're searching for that candle, with his book recommendation, here's Robert Kirkwood.
It is always quietly thrilling to find yourself looking at a world you know well, but have never seen from such an angle before. I was perhaps 50 feet above the ground, which in mid-Norfolk more or less guarantees a panorama.
It took a while to narrow down all the books I read for comfort into one single recommendation, but I've decided on Bill Bryson's book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life.
Sometime after we moved into a former Church of England rectory in a village of tranquil anonymity in Norfolk, I had occasion to go up into the attic to look for the source of a slow but mysterious drip. As there are no stairs to the attic in our house, the process involved a tall stepladder and much unseemly wriggling through a ceiling hatch, which was why I had not been up there before, or have returned with any enthusiasm since. When I did finally flop into the dusty gloom and clambered to my feet, I was surprised to find a secret door, not visible from anywhere outside the house, in an external wall. The door opened easily and led out onto a tiny rooftop space, not much larger than a tabletop, between the front and back gables of the house. Victorian houses are often a collection of architectural bewilderments, but this one was starkly unfathomable. Why an architect had troubled to put in a door to a space so lacking in evident need or purpose was beyond explanation. But it did have the magical and unexpected effect of providing the most wonderful view.
Unlike his previous book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, that goes from the Big Bang to the rise of civilization via geology, chemistry, and particle physics. And unlike other history books that tackle war, politics, or royalty, this is a much more domestic approach. What does history really consist of? Centuries of people quietly going about their daily business, sleeping, eating, having sex, endeavouring to get comfortable. And where did all these normal activities take place? At home.
Houses are amazingly complex repositories. What I found, to my great surprise, is that whatever happens in the world, whatever is discovered or created or bitterly fought over, eventually ends up, in one way or another, in your house. Wars, famines, the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment, they're all there in your sofas and chests of drawers, tucked into the folds of your curtains, in the downy softness of your pillows, in the paint on your walls, and the water in your pipes. So the history of household life isn't just a history of beds and sofas and kitchen stoves, as I had vaguely supposed it would be, but of scurvy and guano and the Eiffel Tower and bedbugs and body snatching and just about everything else that has ever happened. Houses aren't refuges from history. They're where history ends up.
I spoke to Bill Bryson for Read On, and he told me the idea was essentially a lazy one. Known for his travel books and the amount of travelling he did for A Short History of Nearly Everything gave him the idea that he could maybe start a journey simply around the rooms of his own house, considering how the ordinary things in life came to be. So the bathroom provides the occasion for a history of hygiene, the bedroom, sex, death and sleep, the kitchen, nutrition and the spice trade, how the hall became the most demoted room in the house, from being a grand space to a dinky room where we take off our shoes and hang our coats. Along the way, we get the history of anything and everything, architecture to electricity, food preservation, epidemics, the Crystal Palace and the Eiffel Tower. And in the audiobook version I listened to, narrated by Bill Bryson himself, you'll find there's a huge amount of history, interest, excitement and even a little danger lurking in the corners of every home.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and now on the Happy Hour, we're going to hear about a fabulous book from its brilliant author. Red Cell has more.
Dr. Amit Patel is a disability rights campaigner, motivational speaker, and accessibility and diversity consultant who's worked as a volunteer for RNIB. His book, Kika and Me, How One Extraordinary Guide Dog Changed My World, was published to spread his message of positivity and inclusivity, and it's taken him on quite a journey. And I'm delighted to say that both Amit and Kika are here with me in the studio today. Oh, and by the way, if you're wondering what those sounds are in the background, Kika had a good old sniff of her surroundings before settling down and falling asleep. Dr. Amit Patel, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much.
So a lot of listeners will know your story, but for those who don't, can you tell us a little bit about losing your sight and the early years of getting to terms with it?
Yeah, so I lost my sight due to a hemorrhage in the back of my eyes, and it happened so very quickly that we didn't really have any time to plan. It happened overnight. So life changed dramatically for us. Getting grips with sight loss was the challenging part. Due to the fact that it went so quickly, I kind of hoped it would come back very quickly, and I think that was what I was holding on to. I think it was that you don't want to admit that you're blind. You know, you're listening to the consultants, even though they were telling me there's not a lot of things they can do, really. But you kind of just hope that someone will find a miracle. It took me a long time to get to grips that I lost my sight. But when I did, I think that's when my journey really began.
Yeah. Your background is medical. You were working for the Red Cross as a trauma doctor. Yet even you were hoping for that medical miracle against the evidence.
Oh, absolutely. With me, it's very much science matters. I'm someone who actually follows the science. Miracles happen. They do happen. And I hoped it would happen to me. But as a doctor, I know what to expect. And my doctor's hat would say, Amit, get used to it now, this is your life. But deep down, I kind of hope that one in a million chance, something might just be out there.
And your shock and grief was compounded by some pretty unpleasant encounters with members of the public, which led you to put a GoPro on your guide dog. It didn't exactly encourage you to go back outdoors after you lost your sight, did it?
No. I think the one thing I never really thought about when I lost my sight was how lonely it is. And I think it's being in your own world by yourself all of the time. I don't have any useful vision at all. I see a blue mist. I have lots of floaters in my eyes. But it's the fact that when you're on a train or you're out by yourself, you have to think about what you're doing and you have to think ahead of where you're going. And I think people don't realize just how much mental energy you actually need to just do a simple trip. It might look effortless to someone watching, you know, swiping your white cane, walking down the road, you read the tactiles on the pavement, but it's a lot of hard work. But even being on a train and hearing noises around you, I don't put my headphones on because I listen out for the audio announcements, I listen out for all the dangers. So a 5-minute journey in a tube feels like it's half an hour, and it feels like nobody wants to talk to me. I can't talk to anybody else. I don't have an eye contact. I've never ever felt that before in my life. But the one thing that really shocked me was how other people would treat a disabled person. You'd think that when the doors open on a train, that people who see the white cane would give you just a few extra seconds just to step off. Not everybody does. You know, the majority do, but you get those one or two people who want to barge you out the way, want to beat you to an escalator, or just say things like, you shouldn't be on the train at peak time, it's too busy for you. As if being blind means you can't ride a train, or you don't have any work to do, or you just like riding the train for fun. And then it got to a point when I did get Kika, that Kika would stop in the middle of a very busy environment, and she would back herself onto me and sit down on my feet. And that's her way of saying, we're not moving. And for me, I would just assume that it's because it's a busy environment. She's waiting for people to move out of the way or maybe settle herself down, find her route, because it was very early on in our partnership that she was doing this. And it was only when someone came over to me and said, are you okay? And I said, oh yes, I'm just waiting for my guide dog to get her bearings. And this lady said to me, did you not know this, but your dog actually got hit by an umbrella. She got swiped across the face, and that's why she sat on your feet. And I kind of went home and I said to my wife, wouldn't it be great to just have a Kika eye view? Wouldn't it be great? Because if you're in a busy environment, Kika sees the back of your legs. That's it. She doesn't see the sign. She doesn't know which tunnel she's going down. But yet she gets me to A to B every single time. I said, wouldn't it be fantastic to actually show people what Kika sees? And maybe they would appreciate giving guide dog owners or white cane owners, you know, just a little bit of space just to help navigate themselves around. The day we put the camera on her, we actually got 3 people pushing Kika out the way. We got footage of people trying to beat her to an escalator, and just before she jumps onto the escalator, people would push her and barge her out the way. And I thought, do you know what? This is not acceptable. This is not acceptable. So we were very reluctant at first to put anything out on social media, because with social media, it kind of goes 2 ways. You don't want to be that angry disabled person, but then you kind of want to show the world, this is what you have to cope with every single day. And just maybe look up, look around you, just appreciate that it might take an extra 10 seconds for you to get off the escalator. But there's someone who's doing this as a blind person and still doing the same commute you do without the use of any useful vision. When we did put it out there, people were shocked, but that didn't stop people from still doing it. So it's an ongoing thing. The amount of times we get pushed and shoved on an escalator, I would say on average, it's about 3-4 times a week. The comments, you should use the stairs Well, why don't you use the stairs? Yeah. It's as simple as that. Or you've made me miss my train. Well, leave a little bit earlier. Put a buffer in there. I do it. Why can't you do it? It's very, very simple. But for every one person who's horrible, there's a million good people out there. And there's so many people who want to help.
I couldn't agree more. The book is called Kika and Me, and she's very patient. She's underneath the studio desk. Listeners might be able to hear her shaking her head from time to time, hopefully not disagreeing with me. And Kika is very much part of the family, isn't she? I believe she was at the birth of one of your daughters.
She was there for both births. So, being a dad, so Kika came first. I think she was the practice of having kids. You wake up, the first thing you think about is Kika. The last thing you think about is Kika. Whatever you do, you think about Kika. So my mindset now is very much Kika, Kika, Kika. And then we found out we were expecting. And I think that was probably one of the hardest things to accept, because I thought, how am I going to be a blind dad? I'm going to miss out on so much. And my wife said to me, she sat me down and said, Amit, you're not going to miss out on anything. You can do everything. We just have to do it differently. And I thought, you know what? If I'm going to be a dad, I'm going to be the best dad I can. So we were there through all the appointments. The first time Kika heard the heartbeat of my son, her ears pricked up and she laid her head on my wife's tummy just to say, I'm looking after you now. And she was there throughout all the appointments. And the day my son was born, she was in the room with us, which was amazing. When my daughter was born 7 months ago, it was so quick from my wife going into labour that we had no choice but to bring my son with us as well. So my son was in the room, Kika was in the room. Kika kept my son calm and relaxed. And yeah, it was an experience.
The book is out. It's called Kika and Me, How One Extraordinary Guide Dog Changed My Life. Were you involved in it being recorded as an audiobook?
Yes, so the whole process of writing the book was probably more difficult than it needed to be. Assistive tech is fantastic. Assistive tech is fantastic when it works. You know, the amount of edits and the changes you have to do, and then I think I've sent it across to the editor, and then she's like, oh, you haven't done anything, Amit. And, you know, you kind of forget how it takes a little bit longer to do things. But I was very concerned about the audiobook. The audiobook was one thing that I wanted out on the same day as publication. Mm. There's a lot of publishing houses out there who don't do that as standard. They'll wait 6 months or 9 months or a year to release an audiobook. But, you know, imagine a blind guy writing a book and it not being accessible. So it was the forefront that when we do have this book out, that there's an audiobook to accompany it. So we had this amazing gentleman called Chetan Paddock, who is a newsreader for BBC. The moment I heard the prologue of the book is when I really thought, well, do you know what? This is it. This is the one thing I wanted to have that, you know, anybody could pick up and listen to, and it's my voice. But the great thing is, for the RNIB library, I've actually done a little bit of talking myself, and there's little bits of extra stuff in there in the contents, which I wanted to get across as well. But the lovely thing is, my wife actually wrote a chapter in the book, because people forget, sight loss, it wasn't just me, it was my family. Me and my wife, we just got married just before I lost my sight. So it's great to have her voice in there. And she sat down and she's read the chapter herself.
So, audiobook or braille book?
50-50. When I used to read as a sighted person, I love the pictures that I can actually build in my head. Sometimes I feel with an audiobook, they're kind of painted for me. It's like watching TV. It's already there. I like to get lost in a book. And I like to take it at my own pace. I'll go back a chapter and read it again. Because, oh, did I miss this? Did I miss this at all? And with an audiobook, it's kind of difficult to do that. But it depends where I am and what I'm doing. The only braille books I read at the moment is children's books. Anything from Peppa Pig to The Hungry Caterpillar to absolutely anything my son wants to read and we can get hold of in braille. But when you're relaxing, it's nice to just have an audiobook in the background.
What I love about the book is it's not just your story. You have two amazing supportive females in your life, your wife and Kika, and it's about you interacting as a blind person in a sighted world. And I think all of us have something to learn from it. It's a very thoughtful book. You've clearly mulled these questions over a long time in your head.
It's funny. It feels like I've lived with sight loss for such a long time. But in reality, it isn't that long. A lot of things have happened in such a short amount of time. I put that down to the people around me. I've always been a believer of communities. If there was a patient at hospital who didn't have anybody to come in and visit them or anything, after my shift, I'd go and spend 20 minutes, half an hour, having a conversation with someone, because I know what that means. I grew up in a town in Guildford where everybody knew everybody else. You say hello to people, you're kind, you're considerate, people are looking out for each other. And that has always been with me. And that's something my parents have installed in me and my brother. It's not about you. It's about the wider community. So when I lost my sight, I felt that I lost my community. I felt that I can't see my community and they're not there anymore. But they were. Every single person was there. And you don't want to admit that you're going through so much pain. Everybody else knows you're going through that, but you're trying to hide this, and you're wasting energy trying to hide this, which is the worst thing. Then you're tired all the time. It's a vicious circle. But it's the people around you. It's the people who just say, I mean, do you want a coffee? Let's just go here. Let's just do this. What do you want to do? You know, and just take my mind off things and not talk about sight loss. Not talk about, oh, how is your day going? Let's just talk about something completely different and take me away from the whole sight loss thing for even an hour. That's what it's all about. And I'm very lucky.
It's a phenomenal story. I recommend Kika and Me to all our listeners. They'll all be able to find the enhanced audiobook version in the RNIB library. Dr. Amit Patel, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Red over there chatting with Dr. Amit Patel. And his book actually sounds really, really, really good. And actually, if I remember correctly, Holly, you've listened to it, haven't you?
I have, yeah. Honestly, it's such a brilliant book. I would 100% recommend it. When I was reading it, I just found some of it so relatable. I mean, I haven't got a guide dog myself, maybe one day, but so many aspects of his sight loss journey he discussed so openly and in such an authentic way, but they were just really relatable and it made me really emotional. And I guess for someone to paint the picture in that way and describe it in a way that you can just think to yourself, you know what, that is just me, is just really powerful.
You know what? I'll add it to my list. I'll be on holidays soon, so I might actually listen to it. And if you want to join me and listen to it as well, just visit readingservices.rnib.org.uk and you can listen to it for free and just enjoy it.
Now, we're slowly coming to the end of today's happy hour, but we still have time for another book recommendation. Here's Toby Davey with his comfort read.
Rebus thought again of the books he'd decided he couldn't live without, even if he would never read them. The albums he played maybe once or twice a decade, but still clung to. The boxes of case files that seemed a veritable part of him, like an extra limb. Why would he part with them when he had a spare bedroom no overnight guest ever graced?
So I was asked to choose a book that I might pick up as a sort of pick-me-up that might take me away from, I suppose, the day-to-day life, really, and take me to another place. And I have actually chosen one book from Ian Rankin's The Inspector Rebus series. There is about 23 or 24 of them. But the one that I've chosen that I couldn't not put down is A Song for the Dark Times, which is his most recent Inspector Rebus book.
Rebus had forgotten how long the drive took. A distance of around 250 miles, and he could swear he'd done it in under 4 hours in the past. Today, however, it was more than five, with just the one stop to refuel car and driver both, giving the Sab's bonnet a reassuring pat to let it know he appreciated the effort. The A9 itself hadn't been too bad, considering. Some lorries and caravans and a couple of sets of roadworks. The process of duelling was ongoing and would continue to be ongoing long after Rebus had headed to the traffic-free highway in the sky. He hadn't thought to bring anything. There was just the one CD in the car, a compilation Siobhan had burned for him. She'd written the words Songs for Dark Times on the disc in black felt pen.
Rebus has left the police force. He's retired now, and his sort of lifestyle of spending a lot of time in the Oxford bar in Edinburgh drinking and the odd cigarette and stuff and things have caught up with him. And the beginning of A Song for the Dark Times starts with Rebus having to move from his second floor tenement flat, which he's been in for years and years and years, to a ground floor flat because his health is not very good. He's finding it difficult to walk up the stairs and stuff and things like that. But it starts with him moving into this ground floor flat and his longtime sort of friend. Yeah, I think Siobhan is a friend who is in the police force and they used to work together on cases. And she learned a lot from Rebus over the years. And Siobhan is helping him move into his new flat. But as he's moved in, he gets a call in the middle of the night from his daughter, Samantha. They haven't been very close and he hasn't really seen her that much because of the job and everything else. But she calls him to say that her husband has disappeared. And Rebus then obviously dashes off to town where she lives on the sort of coast in Scotland. And the sort of the story unfolds around the disappearance of her husband and it just, you know, it takes Rebus to a slightly different place and he does find out some various things that are happening around that area which all sort of come back to some connections to Edinburgh and Big Jer Cafferty, who's the big sort of crime figure in Edinburgh. Rebus and Cafferty have had a relationship over the years, which has sometimes been slightly blurred.
You reckon it's nothing to worry about? He inquired.
Early days. If she'd not mentioned the affair and I'd found out after, I might have wondered what else she wasn't telling me.
He paused, studying Rebus's face.
I know she's not always had it easy. She was 12, wasn't she, when that nutcase got hold of her? Held a fearsome grudge against you.
30-odd years back.
Then a hit and run in her 20s. She was in a wheelchair for a time. Still has a trace of a limp when she walks.
Is this us playing detective top trumps?
Aren't top trumps a bit after your time? You're forgetting I've got a granddaughter, plus a daughter who's turned out perfectly well adjusted, despite your insinuations. I've not met too many folk who are perfectly well adjusted, Mr. Rebus. Go look at the car, head home, file your report.
Leaving you here to do what exactly?
Help my daughter as best I can. Rebus opened the door and disappeared back inside.
It is one of those books that I can't put down. I just had to listen to it because I listened to the audiobook version. And that was mainly not only Rankin's descriptions and writing, but it's also James McPherson's narration and his depiction of the various characters. I can't watch any dramatizations of Rebus at all. I know it was on TV. There was a series of Rebus on TV and I couldn't watch it because I have an image of Rebus and Siobhan and Cafferty and Edinburgh and everything else in my mind from the books and from James McPherson's narration. And I don't think I could see that in a TV version. So my recommendation is A Song for the Dark Times by Ian Rankin, which is the most recent Inspector Rebus book. And I think Ian Rankin has the next one coming out later on this year, and I suspect I will be downloading the audiobook version of that one and probably listening to it from start to finish.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from RNIB Connect Radio.
Sheik, bringing us to the end of today's happy hour and our book special part two. If you missed part one, which we played out last month, just have a look at our podcast and listen there.
Look for RNIB Happy Hour podcast online to listen.
Now, playing us out on today's show with his music, A Therapy Moment, we have the bookworm himself, our other bookworm, Robert Kirkwood, who will return to share a track that means a lot to him. But remember, you can also recommend a track for the end of the show if you'd like.
Yeah, just get in touch via our email. It's radio@rnib.org.uk. Now it's a goodbye from us. Make sure to tune in again next week at the same time for more happiness and music. And let's have this last track, Robert, take it away.
My musical therapy moment is a nice chilled track by a band called 07. It's called Destiny. It features Sia on vocals and I like it because of its pace. I used to snowboard a lot and although that sounds exciting, the preferred method I used for snowboarding was big, long, lazy turns down the hill. Not jumping off anything, not spinning around, just carving up the hill nice and slowly with some chilled music in my headphones. It sounds like a song that wants to give you a big hug, and I'll forgive you if you maybe sway a little bit. Here's 07 and Destiny.
You are listening to the Happy Hour podcast, a trimmed down version of our hour-long show. If you've enjoyed the songs and would like to hear them in full, along with all the interviews, tips and chat, just catch the full show on RNIB Connect Radio. We're on every Monday at 1 p.m. with a repeat Thursday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m. But for now, thank you for listening to the Happy Hour podcast.
For more downloads like these, visit rnibconnectradio.org.uk/podcasts.